This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
So I'm here at the University of Western Ontario with Dr. Irene Antonenko, who's one of the postdoctoral fellows here, and also the coordinator of the Canadian Lunar Research Network. Welcome to the Jodcast, Irene.
Thank you.
Could you tell us a little bit about what the CLRN actually is?
Yes, the Canadian Lunar Research Network, or the CLRN, is a network of researchers all across Canada who are working towards understanding the moon, going to the moon, exploring the moon. We have a very broad mandate. We include professors, graduate students, postdocs, as well at universities, as well as people in industry, people who are doing research on a wide range of topics, everything like lunar geology, which is what I do. We also have people who are working on robotic systems, robotic navigation systems for navigating on the moon, spacecraft, hardware, development of propulsion systems, how to get to the moon, how to navigate once you're there, what to do while you're there, and of course, what you can learn when you're there. So we cover all of that in our network. Now, the CLRN is also connected to the NLSI, the NASA Lunar Science Institute, which is a corresponding group of researchers in the U.S. And the NLSI was developed to promote not just research in the U.S., but lunar research in the world. And so their goal is to have a group of researchers, lunar researchers in each country, working together with international partners, collaborating between each other, providing exchanges of people and facilities, allowing the entire world to work towards the exploration of the moon. So Canada, the Canadian group, is actually one of the first partners. We're not just one of the first international partners, we're actually one of the first teams of any kind, U.S. or otherwise, that was selected by the NLSI to join the Institute.
So this begs the question, why Canada? Because Canada isn't famous for its space program. You've got NASA, you've got ESA, the Chinese space program, but Canada doesn't really register.
You may think that. But we do have a Canadian Space Agency,
okay.
And Canada is, of course, responsible for very famous features like the Canada arm on the space shuttle and the corresponding arm on the space station. So Canada is not a new player. We've also been very involved in satellites since the inception. In the 60s, Canada was a world leader in remote sensing technology, and there are still some elements of remote sensing technology where we excel in the world. So Canada is not a non-player.
Mm-hmm.
It is true that we have not led a mission to the moon like India and China and Japan and, of course, the U.S. have, but that is something that we are working on, and the Canadian Space Agency is actually funding Phase A studies on Canadian-led missions to the moon. So hopefully in the future, that will be something that we will see.
So there's obviously been a lot of research done about the moon over all of the decades, and don't we know quite a lot about the moon already? What is there still to find out?
Well, there's an awful lot that we know about the moon, but that doesn't mean that we know everything. There's still an awful lot more to find out, and that's one of the things that we need to spend time and energy and resources on discovering. One of the things that we still don't understand very well is the origin of the Earth itself. Now, because the Earth is very active tectonically, we don't have very many spots on the Earth that still retain evidence of what the Earth was like 4.5 billion years ago. By contrast, the Moon, because it's smaller and cooled faster, is what we call a tectonically dead planet. It doesn't have plate tectonics, it doesn't have volcanism currently pumping up and creating new crust, and you don't have subduction zones destroying old crust. So a lot of what we see on the moon has been there for billions of years. So in effect, what the moon does is give us a snapshot of what the Earth may have been like when it was 4.5 billion years old. So by studying the moon, in fact, what we're doing is studying the early history of the Earth. And there are a lot of questions about the early history of the moon and the Earth that we still don't know. For example, we know from our studies of the moon that the moon had an original thick crust. That's what you see when you look at the bright areas of the moon. And then this thick crust was intruded by lava, which flooded the surfaces, making these dark, marry areas that you see when you look up at the moon. What we still don't understand is how this actual process occurred. How did the volcanism begin? Why did the volcanism begin? Was the volcanism caused by impacts that thinned the crust and allowed the mantle to uplift and melt and extrude on the surface? Or was it the decay of radioactive elements in the interior that caused the mantle to melt, and it was just that in the basins you had thinner crust, and therefore that's where the magma could make it through to the top? Or was it that, you know, magma came up wherever it did and just flowed downhill into the natural lows of basins? These are the kinds of questions that we don't know. These are the kinds of questions that may be very fundamental to understanding how plate tectonics began on the Earth. So these are the types of questions that we want to address when we look at the moon and say we must go back, we must get more samples, we must get more data.
Surely we can look at the Earth as it is now and see where volcanism is happening here and use that to go back in time, maybe to as you said, the moon as it is now, the Earth as it was then. We can see the Earth as it is now and maybe find our way back.
That's a really interesting question, because you would think we are able to backtrack from our current understanding of the present Earth back through Gondwana land, for example, and, you know, this opening and closing of the Atlantic. We do understand all that, and we can go back and do all that, but something that we're still not clear on is how do you actually get plate tectonics to start? We don't know how that happens. We can keep it going once it started, but we don't have an understanding to date of how to get the whole process rolling. And we can look at Venus, for example, and there's a big debate going on. Does Venus have plate tectonics? And some people say, oh, yes, it does, but nothing like we have on the Earth. They think that on Venus, for example, you have a one-plate planet where the planet is stable, and then every 500 million years or so, all of a sudden there's this massive overturn, and you resurface the entire planet. Well, that's nothing like what we have on the Earth. So why would that happen on Venus when you're having the tectonics that we understand on Earth happening here? Why one? Why not the other? Why either at all? So those are all questions that we do not understand the answers to. So there's a lot more to be learned there other than, oh, well, we understand how plate tectonics works and that's it. We have no idea how it starts. We have no idea why it's the way it is on the Earth as opposed to any other system that you could possibly imagine.
So let's move on to what your particular field of study is.
Well, I actually study the moon. I study the geology of the moon. And one of the questions I try to address is precisely, what is happening with volcanism on the moon? We originally thought it was a very simple question. You had an ancient crust, you had some big impact craters form, creating basins, there was lava that filled up the basins, voila, you've got big black blotches on big white areas. We thought that was that simple. But in fact, it's not that easy, because the volcanism did not all happen in one big event. There were multiple events, and in between those events, you had other impacts happening in other places. And so if you can imagine, you've got a small mare in a basin, and then you have an impact occurring somewhere on a highland area, which is light and bright, and it ejects material onto your dark mare area. Now all of a sudden, your dark mare area is no longer dark-looking, it's now bright-looking. Mm-hmm. So now you have something that is called a crypto-mare or hidden mare. Mm-hmm. Time moves on, and you have more volcanism, more basalt flows on top, and so now you've got basalt flow on top of your highland ejecta, which is on top of your older basalt, and so forth. And so over time, you can build up quite a layer cake, mm-hmm, of this kind of dark Mari material, bright ejecta from Highlands material, dark Mari, etc., etc. So one of the things that I do is I try to figure out the stratigraphy of this layer cake. Mm-hmm. And how we do this is with a bunch of remote sensing tools. Because unlike on the Earth, you can't, you know, hire yourself a drill rig with a team and go out there and get yourself some really nice core down to depth, pull it up and say, ah, yes, for X number of meters we have basalt, then we have a layer of ejecta. You can't do that. So we need to use natural drills or other craters that then impact after all of this has happened and excavate part of that stratigraphy, part of that layer cake, and basically display that layer cake to us either in the walls of the crater or in the ejecta that they excavate.
If an impact is happening on an area you want to study, isn't that going to cause a lot of maybe changes, some metamorphosis within the rock, or isn't it going to muck up some of the results?
Well, it certainly does do a lot of interesting things, but they are interesting things that we actually have some understanding of what's going on. Now, impacts on planetary bodies are not like the impacts that most of us are familiar with from our daily lives. It's not like you take a rock and throw it at some sand and you see a bit of a pit and then you see the rock in the middle and there's some damage and that's what it looks like. That's not at all what happens at the planetary scale. The planetary scale, you have what's called hypervelocity impacts. These objects hit each other at phenomenal speeds, often on the order of 10 kilometers per second.
Oof. Yeah.
So that's fast. And so when something hits, when a moving object that fast hits a solid target, the dynamics of what happens is completely different from what we're used to from our daily lives of impacts, you know, our daily experience of impact. First of all, the impactor, the moving thing, is completely obliterated. Secondly, the impact sets up a shock through the actual target material, which causes a lot of things to set into motion, including the material that's been hit. And so what happens is that the material directly beneath the impact starts to move down, and as it moves down, the shock wave decreases, and it starts to slow down, eventually stopping. But the material slightly off to the side from where the impactor hit experiences a very different path. It actually experiences a U-shaped path down, across, and up, and out, creating your ejecta that then gets excavated and emplaced around the crater rim. So you have this basic bowl shape excavation path happening that takes a bunch of material, a lot more than the size of the impactor that hit, and removes it away from the target area. Mm-hmm. So what you end up with is a big hole where a lot of material has been displaced down, off to the side, or even up, and a lot of material that has been displaced completely outside of the hole. So most of the material that was completely crushed to pieces has been removed away from the crater. A lot of it is compressed down. So you do get a different result than if you had just taken a backhoe and dug out a crater of that size. But it's processes that we understand to some extent, and we can adjust for that. So if you can imagine that you started off with a layer cake, very, very perfect, you know, perfect layers, you know, all is the same size across, and you impacted into that, you can now imagine that all those layers have been slightly depressed and shoved to the side, but you're still going to have a remnants of that layer cake, even though it's been slightly deformed and squished. So you can still look at the sides of the crater and see some of that layer cake. Sure, it's going to be slightly squished and depressed, but you're still going to see evidence of the different layers, and that's what we're looking for. So yeah, our estimate of how deep that layer was originally may be slightly off, and those are areas that we definitely need to do more research on. But we can get a first-order estimate of What was there? How deep was it? How many different layers were there? At least that's the expectation. Also, when material is ejected out of the crater, it's ejected in a very specific way, and therefore material further away from the crater is often more likely to come from deeper in the crater, so you can kind of have a reverse stratigraphy displayed for you on the surface in the ejecta. And so if we can tap that compositional information from the ejecta, then we can also get that kind of information there.
Okay. So how do we get the data in the first place? Because, as you say, it's not like we can just get our drill and go and drill down.
Right. It's worse than you can't get your drill and go down. You can't even go down, pick up rocks and bring them back and study them in the lab. That's the holy grail of lunar exploration, is we would love to get lots of landers and rovers crawling around the moon, picking up rocks, bringing them back, either bringing them back to Earth for analysis, or having mini labs on the moon where you could actually do your analysis right there on the spot. So that's our holy grail. But we don't have that at the moment, so we have to make do with what we do have. And what we do have are remote sensing techniques. There are several data sets that have a multispectral component. And what that means is that when you look at an image that's black and white, usually that means you are looking at an image that was taken with all the possible light that a camera can collect. So that's panchromatic. Mm-hmm. Multispectral says, okay, well, I don't want every single bit of light. I just want light from this particular region of spectrum. Mm-hmm. So I want to look at just red or just blue or just green light. And so when you do this for many different wavelengths or colors, you get what is called a multispectral image. So you have very specific information at every different wavelength or color. Now, the neat thing about that is that most things have a very specific response at different wavelengths. So you plot up your, here's my how much light I get back from this particular object, here's the wavelength, and it gives me this great little curve, right? So it's not a solid line, it's not a straight line, it's not like everything reacts exactly the same at every different color, it reacts differently at different colors, and so I get this lovely squiggly line. And through lots of study, we have figured out what the squiggly line looks like for different types of materials. So it's called spectroscopy. We can, by looking at the spectra, the squiggle, we can see what this material is. Now, that's great and wonderful if the area that we're looking at is one type of material only. But, of course, reality is not like that. Usually we have mixes of materials. So now we have to use algorithms to try and unmix and say, okay, this squiggly line is a composition of that squiggly line, that squiggly line, that squiggly line, and that squiggly line. And furthermore, it's 50% that squiggly line, 10% that squiggly line, et cetera, et cetera. So we actually do have the capabilities to do that, and that allows us to give us some information about what is happening on the moon from a compositional level. So now we can say, okay, we've got some basalt, we've got some highland material. We can even say we have this type of basalt or that type of basalt, and we have this type of highland material. So it's a very powerful tool, and the detectors are just getting better and better. So we hopefully should be able to do some really interesting compositional and stratigraphical studies with this kind of data. Mm-hmm.
And do you also pick up the traces of what originally bashed into the moon, or is that just too small for...
Too small. It's just way too small. Mm-hmm. First of all, the amount of material that gets excavated is on an order of magnitude or more greater than the amount of material that impacted in the first place. Mm-hmm. So you're looking for literally a needle in a haystack. Mm-hmm. And even doing terrestrial studies of craters where you can walk along the thing, you have days, months, years to look for impact material, even then it can be very difficult to do so. It can be done, but it can be very difficult to do so. On the moon, we don't have that luxury. Mm-hmm. We don't have that luxury because we have not figured out a way to keep astronauts up there for years. Mm-hmm. And we have not figured out a way to get intelligent enough robot systems to do that autonomously. Mm-hmm. So that is a real difficulty on the moon.
So what have we found then?
Well, what we have found is in fact that it is the layer cake, mm-hmm. and not a strict big blotch of basalt on a big area of highland. We found that it's much more complex, and that's exactly what my research is doing. And I look for ways of improving on our knowledge in that respect. My specific research works on fusing data from as many different data sets as I can. One of the things I love to do is I like to take topography data, which tells you the elevation of everything. I try to then take some sort of a picture type data, which just gives me what things look like, so that it's familiar to the eye-brain combination. So it's familiar to what the human eye is used to seeing, and I overlay that on top of the topography data, so you can actually see, you know, the hills and the mountains and the craters. And then on top of that, I like to lay other information, usually compositional. For example, you can take Clementine multispectral data, and from that we have some great algorithms that tell you what the iron content of the area in question is, and so I can overlay that on top. The reason why iron information is interesting is because basalts contain much more iron than highlands, so that's a great indicator of what you're looking at. Also, I have some personal algorithms that I have developed for identifying specifically basalt spectra. So instead of having to look at every single pixel in a 100 million pixel image, I can just set my computer to run and tell me, here are where the interesting basalt spectra are, go look there. Mm-hmm. I overlay that on top, and then I also take old geological maps from the Apollo era that have been developed, and I register them electronically, and I overlay that so I can see what other people have thought was going on in this area, and so I can use all of this built-up information to try and understand the area better.
Okay. The fact that we're using old photos and data as well as new photos and data, is the old data good enough to work with the new data?
Yes, actually. In fact, some of the old data is phenomenal in comparison to some of the newer data for different reasons. For example, we had during the pre-Apollo era when they were trying to figure out where to go, they had a series of orbiters called lunar orbiters that took amazing pictures. For example, we have an entire lunar data set of what the moon looks like at every point, almost every point, there's a few missing spots, but almost every point at relatively high resolution, better resolution than Clementine data. So that in itself is great. I use that all the time because it has a very good feel for this is what you're seeing. It also gives you a bit of topography data because you have shadows which tell you where you've got hills and where you've got depressions, and so that gives you a really good feel for what you're seeing. The Clementine data is good for other things in other regions. So you can use both of those data to give you more information than either one would give you alone. Mm-hmm. The trick comes in trying to make sure that the crater from one data set matches up with the crater from the other data set. And that can be a technical nightmare, but it's something that we work at, because I find that the results are so amazingly visual. You get this visual gestalt that is just much more intuitive than seeing the individual images side by side when you see them laid on top of the other. So the benefits really are worth the effort.
You mentioned India is going to the moon?
Yes, India has already sent an orbiter to the moon. It's called Chandrayaan-1,
okay. And
it was in orbit for several months, almost a full year, collecting a variety of data. There were international partners. They had instruments from a variety of nations, including one from NASA, led by a team from Brown University with Carly Peters. Mm-hmm. And they had a fabulous multispectral instrument on board. Mm-hmm. The data has not yet been released to the public, but will be hopefully in the summer, and I can't wait for that.
Another thing is, I read somewhere that moon dust is highly corrosive. Is that true?
Okay. It's not highly corrosive, it's highly abrasive.
Okay, abrasive, sorry.
Yes. And yes, that is true. It is, imagine the worst fiberglass dust ever.
Right.
Multiplied.
Wow.
So you have, basically you have the lunar regolith is made up of a lot of glasses, and when glass breaks, you know it's very shardy.
Right.
And so you've got an entire surface made up of shards of glass at fine, fine scales.
Right.
And these things get into the astronauts' clothing, and they rub against everything, and they get into seals, and yes, it's very, very abrasive.
And what would happen if the astronauts actually breathed some of that, if it got inside?
That is something that there are people who are actually studying those kinds of issues, the health effects of lunar dust.
Right.
That's not my specialty, so I can't comment on it.
Of course.
But that is definitely an ongoing area of research, a very serious area of research.
Okay.
One of the biggest things about dust is, so if you're going to have a base on the moon where astronauts are going in and out of a habitat area for prolonged periods of time, you know, you need to really be careful about making sure that that dust from their spacesuit, because they have to come in suited from outside, take their suit off, and then go into a habitat area, and you have to be very careful about making sure that the dust does not get into the habitat area, that they are protected when they're in that enclosure where they're removing their spacesuit, because they don't want to be breathing it in at that point either. So those are really big issues of concern, both for the doctors on those kinds of teams and the engineers.
Because I think that's something that most of the general public isn't aware of, how abrasive, as you said, that lunar dust can be.
Yeah.
I think for most people, they think of the moon as a giant rock that's just sitting there that's solid. Is that true, or does the moon actually have a molten core? Is there actually a liquid element to the moon?
We don't quite know.
Okay.
There is definitely no liquid iron core in the interior.
Mm-hmm.
What is in the interior is probably something that is an iron silicate mixture, which means iron and rock. Silica is just a fancy word for what most of the rocks you see on the Earth are.
Mm-hmm.
Most, not all.
Mm-hmm.
What the state of it is, we don't know. It's certainly not fluid like water, but it may be more fluid than, say, the rocks under your feet. Where between those two it falls, we're not quite sure.
Why haven't we been back to the moon so far?
Well, one of the problems, I think, is really a public perception problem. There's a real been there, done that attitude about the moon, which we don't have about Mars, for example. So people are interested about going to Mars. There's something exciting there. There's the possibility of life. We've not explored it. And that's the attitude about Mars. And that's unfortunately an attitude that's lacking about the moon in the general public. Scientists, of course, will tell you there's lots to be studying on the moon, and we should be having rovers crawling all over the planet, giving us that information. But it's really a matter, I think, of public will.
Well, Irene, I wish you all the very, very best for your work and for the new results that will be coming out very soon. And thank you very much for your time. We will link to your website and all of the details on the show notes. So if anyone does want to find out any more, they'll be in the show notes there. But thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you very much for having me.